Hello there, and welcome to Short Science, your international era-spanning portal for all the very best science in brief. I'm Elizabeth Hawke. Now, we're casting an eye over the Atlantic to consider the effects of the BP oil spill in capsule medicine, while in capsule science we'll be considering our dependence on fossil fuels. Plus, we'll be opening up our voicemail to see if any listeners have decided to brave the radio waves and send in any content for us to play out during the show. This is Short Science. So, last week we kicked off a brand new year of Short Science with some slight changes to the show format and a pretty big change to the content. Now, if you were listening last week, you'll have heard us wittering on about you sending in content for us to play out on the show. So what is this new idea? Have we just got so lazy that we can't write a whole show each week? Well, the idea is that you've all had a year of listening to us tell you about science. And expert scientific minds though we might be, we know there are people out there listening who have things to say about science. So you might be a scientist listening to the show, a student, a parent, a farmer, shopkeeper, teacher. I could go on and on, but you get my drift. We in the Short Science Studio don't have a monopoly on science or on making science interesting, so we want everyone listening to the show to get involved. So we did go over this last week, but I'm just going to remind you of all the different ways, again, you can send in content to the show. So starting with the most low-tech way, you can send us an email. Now, it could be your thoughts, comments, questions, suggestions, or even a full-blown article or commentary. Unless you say otherwise, this will be pasted onto our news page on the Short Science website, and then anybody else who looks at the website can post a comment or reply to you. So the email address to send those emails to is studio@shortscience.co.uk, and our website is shortscience.co.uk. Now, we were having a few teething problems with the website, but after a nightmare weekend chasing myself around name servers and DNS settings, everything is now working. So now let's move on to the higher tech ways where you can get involved in the show. See, ideally, if you've got something to say, we'd like to hear your voice saying it. So we've set up a 24-hour dedicated recording service just waiting to take your messages. Now, the number you need to call to record your message is +44 7401 856 681. So that's 07401 856 681. And if you've got a lot to say and you get cut off, just call back and keep talking, and we'll splice the parts of what you've got to say together before we play you out on air. And I should just say that is a mobile number, so you will be charged whatever it's going to cost you to call a mobile phone. Now, you can leave anything on there. Hellos, comments, questions, thoughts, commentaries, absolutely anything. Every week we're going to have a topic of the week, so this week we ask people to send in any thoughts on the oil spill, but you don't necessarily need to feel limited by that. Anything and everything is welcome, and everything will get played out on the air at some point. Also, if you want to record your own material, which might be easier if you want to chat in a group or do interviews, then just send us over the MP3 or WAV file by email or file exchange, and we'll do our very best to get that on the air too. So we're going to be telling you more about next week's topic later in the show, so stay tuned to find out more about that. Well, it's time now for the Short Science News in Brief. Asteroid sample hits terra firma. A Japanese space capsule was recovered from the Australian outback at the weekend, thought to contain the first ever samples scooped from the surface of an asteroid. The capsule is now on its way back to Japan for analysis. Heart pills linked to deadly cancer. A common class of blood pressure and heart failure pill called an angiotensin receptor blocker has controversially been linked to a slightly increased risk of cancer. Doctors urge patients to continue taking the drug until more evidence is found to back up this claim. Artificial life shouldn't gain a life of its own. There's been a public demand for regulation in the field of artificial life development following the man-made creation of the first living cell in America. For the first time in scientific research, the public are going to be represented in decisions regarding issues like funding and new research projects. Legionnaire's disease lurks under the bonnet. Researchers have claimed that up to a fifth of all cases of the pneumonia Legionnaire's disease may stem from the bacteria multiplying in windscreen wiper water. The stagnant water that's kept nice and warm under the bonnet is an ideal place for the bacteria to breed. Now, this can easily be prevented by using windscreen wash instead of just water. BP playing down oil loss. independent scientists have estimated that maybe twice as much oil is being released into the ocean as BP have admitted, causing fresh concerns for the marine ecosystem and environmental protection of the Louisiana and Florida coastlines. But to put this into perspective, historically speaking, this isn't even a fifth of the size of the oil spill that occurred during the first Gulf War. Internal radiation to get on top of cancer. An international study led by researchers in the UK and published in The Lancet has found that a single dose of radiotherapy applied internally and directly to the site of cancer during breast surgery is just as effective as a prolonged course of external radiotherapy following surgery. This could shorten the length of treatment for patients and reduce costs and waiting times for the NHS. Popping bubbles don't disappear. James Bird from Harvard University has been describing his finding that when a bubble on the surface of water bursts, it doesn't just disappear, but instead forms a ring of daughter bubbles. These then in turn burst themselves to form rings of granddaughter bubbles. Eventually, when the bubbles get too small, tiny jets form, propelling aerosols of droplets into the atmosphere. This bubble behaviour may help explain the spreading of infection in hot tubs and swimming pools. And finally today, cancer drug stops blindness. News that an established bowel cancer drug called Avastin may help prevent the leading cause of blindness in the Western world, age-related macular degeneration. Doctors have been experimenting with injecting Avastin into patients with the worst kind of age-related macular degeneration. And the best thing is that only a tiny amount of the drug is needed, making it incredibly cost-effective. Doctors are urging drug companies to start clinical trials as soon as possible. Well, that's it for our short science news in brief for today, but perhaps we should check out the archive to see what was hitting the headlines scientifically speaking in the 80s, 90s and noughties. So, August the 12th, 1981, the very first IBM computer was launched. Now, it was created by a team of engineers and designers under the direction of Don Estridge of the IBM Entry Systems Division in Boca Raton, Florida. Now, there were computers around before this. There was the Commodore PET, the 8-bit Atari family, and the Apple II. But the success of the IBM PC led other companies to create IBM compatibles. In other words, things like diskettes that were compatible with the IBM system. No other computer manufacturer had attained this before, with computers previously having no cross-platform functionality at all. So let's take a look at the 90s now. In 1991, carbon nanotubes, or Bucky tubes, were discovered. Now, these are allotropes of carbon with a cylindrical nanostructure. And the significance of this is that their extreme strength and flexibility meant they're a key player in the development of nanotechnologies. So that's everything from sports gear to solar panels. And finally, we come to the noughties. So related to our news item about the Japanese space capsule sampling an asteroid, the year 2001 saw the first spacecraft land on an asteroid. It was the Near Shoemaker, with Near standing for Near Earth Asteroid Rendezvous. So some interesting little tidbits there. Now, if you have any questions or comments about any of our news, either from 2010 or decades past, leave us a message on 07401 856 681 or swing an email out to studio@shortscience.co.uk. So let's press on now with this week's Capsule Science. Prompted by the oil spillage disaster, we thought we'd better find out just what fossil fuels are. So what's oil? Why is it important? And why is it running out? Now, oil is extremely important to all of us. It's part of a group of fossil fuels, which includes coal and natural gas as well. But what do we do with fossil fuels? Well, we burn them to make heat, light, and power to move things like trains and cars. So what we get from fossil fuels is energy. But how do we get that energy? Well, fossil fuels are based around the elements carbon and hydrogen, all bonded together. And breaking apart these bonds releases energy. So if you imagine you were holding hands with somebody and you were dancing and you were pulling away from each other, and then suddenly you let go, you'd stumble far backwards because of all that pent-up energy being released. But you need someone to break your hands apart before that energy can be released. And that's called the activation energy. And that's why fossil fuels are ignited and burnt. Once the activation energy is provided, there's enough energy around to keep breaking bonds and to give out plenty of energy that we can harness for our own use. But where do fossil fuels come from? The reason that fossil fuels are made from hydrogen and carbon is that these fuels originally come from living things. Now, here on Earth, life is carbon-based. Living things are mostly made up of proteins, carbohydrates, fats, and some other bits and bobs. And all of these things contain chains of carbon atoms in various forms with other elements such as hydrogen, which is the most common, oxygen, nitrogen, and various other things surrounding them. Now, oil and natural gas are formed from organisms on the sea floor, such as phytoplankton and zooplankton. Now, when they die, they settle, they get mixed with mud, and they get buried further and further under the sea floor. And that's why oil is often found under the sea. But how exactly do dead organisms become fossil fuels? Well, because they're buried under many layers of sediment over the years, they're exposed to heat and pressure, and they decay with no exposure to oxygen. So all these forces are so great that they alter the composition of the materials making up the organisms. So the makeup, though, remains broadly the same, carbon and hydrogen. So what are the features of fossil fuels? Well, they vary wildly. Methane can be formed, which is also known as a natural gas. It is a very simple one carbon atom bonded to four hydrogen atoms and therefore has a very low carbon to hydrogen ratio. It's also a very small molecule. From then on, you can have any variation of hydrocarbons, which are chains of carbon atoms surrounded by hydrogen atoms. And the rule is that the longer the chain, the less solid the fuel. Now, crude oil is so thick and viscous because it contains some massive hydrocarbons, but when it's refined, they're separated out by size to give some quite thin oils and some which are like sort of sludge, really. Now, coal is at the far end of the spectrum, solid and basically pure carbon. Now, coal is actually formed from plants on the land getting buried and changed, which is why coal mines are found on land. So, is it simply because it takes a long time to create fossil fuels that we could potentially run out? Pretty much, yes it is. Now, although fossil fuels continue to be made every day, we're drilling and mining far faster than plants and other organisms die, get buried, and become subjected to the kind of forces that create fossil fuels. So, what about fossil fuels and the environment? What is so damaging about burning them? Because fossil fuels are carbon and hydrogen based, when they react with oxygen in the air during combustion, they form carbon dioxide and water. Now, initially, this seemed like a pretty useful thing as they're both gases which occur naturally in our atmosphere. Now, oil has been especially practical here because it does burn more fully than coal, which does leave some carbon deposits behind in the form of soot. However, as we now know, releasing large amounts of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere is disrupting the balance and could potentially be disastrous. So that's another reason why we have to look for alternative energy sources. So that's it about fossil fuels for the moment. We're now going to consider the effects of the oil spill in capsule medicine. So this is a little outside my usual area of expertise, but I have been keeping an eye on the situation out in the Gulf of Mexico, and you just can't get away from those pictures of oil-drenched pelicans struggling ashore. But before we start thinking about the animals and sea life, let's just think about what happens when oil spills into the sea. Now, quite obviously, you get an oil slick, so that's oil floating on top of the water. Anyone with even sub-GCSE science should realise that oil has a lower density than water and so will float on the surface of any body of water. Now, this means that the oil will form a relatively thin layer. So if you've got millions of barrels of oil in the sea and you spread it as a very thin layer, you can imagine that it's going to cover a very large surface area, which means that in terms of the area of marine ecosystem affected, or the length of coastline that might be affected, this is going to be disproportionately large compared to the actual size or volume of the oil spill. So the message here is that a little oil goes a really long way. And an easy way to think about this is, you know, when you're washing up and you've got a nice bowl of hot water and then you put something as small as a teaspoonful of oil in the water or a particularly greasy plate even, and then everything afterwards that you wash up comes out slightly greasy, and when you lift your hands out of the water you can feel the grease on your fingers. Well, that's really annoying, and considering the volume of water in the washing up bowl, you'd think that a teeny bit of oil wouldn't be that significant. But it is. It spreads as a fine layer across the whole of the water, coating everything that comes out with grease, and that's the same principle with the oil spill. So we've got oil in the water, it's spread over a wide area. What happens next? Well, when the oil is exposed to air, any volatile organic compounds evaporate, which makes the oil denser and more viscous. At this point, some of the residue may dissolve, some may mix with the seawater into a foamy layer, and some of the oil waste may sink as it mixes with particulate matter in the sea. And the rest tends to congeal into those sticky tar balls that we've all seen Obama rolling around in his fingers on the news. Now, we all keep hearing that the oil might break down naturally. So is that true? Well, over long periods of time, surface oil waste interacts with sunlight by a process called photolysis, or photolysis. Now, this leads to oil decomposition. And also, depending on the temperature and the availability of nutrients, oxygen, and microorganisms in the water, there may be some biodegradation. So there might be some natural breakdown, but not when you think about the volume of oil that's out there. So now let's consider what happens when oil comes into contact with marine life and animals. Now, this really depends on a number of factors. It can depend on the type and quantity of oil spilled, the wildlife that's populating the area, the timing within the reproductive cycle of that wildlife, and even other factors like the weather. But generally speaking, with both marine and coastal ecosystems, there is the potential for direct toxicity from the oil. So crude oil and the breakdown products can be directly poisonous to creatures coming into contact with it. Then there's what we see on the news, the problem of coating. So over time, the surface oil becomes stickier and more viscous. And then with, for example, fish, it can effectively smother them, coating their bodies completely and preventing them from taking water in through their gills to extract oxygen. And then with birds, it mats their feathers down. This makes it really difficult for them to fly away, so they can't hunt or protect themselves from danger. It also means they can't keep themselves warm, and it makes the feathers less waterproof, which makes the birds highly vulnerable to hypothermia. It can also make birds and mammals less buoyant, as the air that's normally trapped in their feathers or fur is replaced by the heavier oil, and so sadly, some animals simply drown. And it does also interfere with normal breeding. It can potentially wipe out one population, but it can also limit the ability of the species to make a comeback. It can affect the reproductive process, so it can affect the eggs, it can affect the reproductive urges of the animals, and it can also affect the health of the offspring. So we're going to have to keep our eyes glued to the news to see how this oil spill takes its toll on the wildlife of the Gulf Coast. And stay tuned through the summer, as we may have further reports on this later in the year. Now, if you've got anything to say, call in your message to 07401 856 681 or bang out an email to studio@shortscience.co.uk. So, this is the part of the show dedicated to short scientists around the world. We want to hear from you. We want to share your thoughts with other short scientists, and we want to take a relatively sort of back seat for this portion of the show. So, let's see, did anybody call into our recording service to leave a message? Well, yes, we've had 3 messages during the week, which I think is pretty good for our first week. So, we're going to go first of all to Italy.
Hi, Short Science, this is Paola Faraca from Perugia, your Italian correspondent. Today we talk about the BP and the environment disaster in the Gulf of Mexico. As many know already, on the 20th of last April, an explosion to the deepwater horizon caused an oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. 11 people died, and the damage to the environment is huge. The BP, that is the third largest world energy company, is facing a big public trial about responsibility on the disaster. Furthermore, its stock value is dropping down day after day at the same speed as the well is releasing oil in the sea. It is fair to say that the BP was running the well without a remote control shut-off switch as a last resort protection against underwater spill. But on the other hand, the use of such devices is now mandated in the US, that has been criticized by many for its weak law regulation over it. In 2 months since the disaster happened, no much has been achieved in the run to stop the oil leaking. The BP had estimated that the loss was 1,000 barrels a day, in contrast with the government estimation of 5,000 a day. Up to now, the quantity has grown, and the action taken seems too soft. If the BP is waving in Blackwater, the US President Barack Obama is facing a hard time too. The public opinion thinks that I didn't have a fast reaction on the problem. The president is trying to rehabilitate himself to the USA citizen and worldwide inhabitants by his getting worse, almost causing a diplomatic crisis with Great Britain, calling the BP with his former name. The wrong word at the wrong moment, President, during a speech, has recalled the 9/11 terror plot, comparing it to the disaster in the Gulf of Mexico, causing an outreaction reaction the victim relatives. It is expected a meeting in the White House with the public chief executive, Mr. Hoyer, but I start to believe in a fast rise from this disaster. Like in Greek tragedy, we should need a deus ex machina to sort out what man calls to his own home, and if the BP will pay a big expensive bill, at the moment what appears clear is that the sea life, the birds, the inhabitants around the coast, and the fish market are paying the bill. Paola Faraca, Short Science.
So, thanks, Paola, ever so much for sending that in. That was really brilliant. All the way from Italy there, our first international report from Paola Faraca. Now, just picking up on a few things that Paola was saying there. So, the Deepwater Horizon was a 9-year-old semi-submersible mobile offshore drilling unit. And at approximately 9:45 on April the 20th, 2010, methane gas from the well under high pressure shot up and out of the drill column marine riser, expanded onto the platform, and then ignited and exploded. After burning furiously for approximately 36 hours, the Deepwater Horizon sank on the morning of April the 22nd, 2010. And we must remember that 11 people lost their lives in this explosion, so there is a really personal element to this tragedy for many families. So one of the main points that Paola's making there is that there's this question of regulation. It seems that there's some very lax regulation and safety precautions that maybe should have been taken weren't taken, but in the US these things aren't mandatory. So there's this always sort of question about whether or not the regulation is tight enough. So thanks very much, Paola. That was really interesting. Let's hear now from our next caller.
Hello, this is a message for Short Science from Gareth Mitchell of Imperial College. I would like to comment on the situation with the BP oil spill, and my observation is that perhaps we shouldn't be surprised, and yet it still is quite curious how the agenda has shifted from being one about the environment and conservation to one about politics, business and commerce. Inevitably, Obama wants to come across as defending the people and the communities and the environment affected by the oil spill, and that will include a bit of anti-British rhetoric. And inevitably, Britain, for its part, wants to safeguard the value of BP as a company and obviously to safeguard those dividends that pay into pension funds. So yes, initially a conservation and environmental agenda that has perhaps inevitably shifted to being one that is about money and politics. Should we be surprised?
So thanks ever so much to Gareth for sending that in. I think this highlights something quite interesting, actually. So Paola's given us a slightly more international perspective, and internationally it seems that Britain and America are seen as sort of nationally responsible for this disaster. So Britain is responsible because BP, British Petroleum, is a British company, and America is seen as being responsible because of the lax regulation and maybe because of the governmental response to the crisis. But in Britain, it's quite hard to kind of feel that. It's not being represented in our media in that way. And all we seem to get is a much more political to and fro, he said, she said, kind of debate. It's not really about the big issues or about responsibility or about what we're doing about it. It's just more political squabbling, really. So it's quite interesting that it does seem to be all about commerce and finance and things that are quite removed from the actual tragedy of the oil spill. Now it's time to hear from our last contributor this week. So all the way from America, thanks to Alicia and Brandy.
The Gulf of Mexico oil spill is the worst environmental disaster in U.S. history, and many Americans are disapproving and disagreeing with the way that President Obama is handling the spill, with 52% being unhappy as of yesterday. Seeing the animals stuck in the oil is absolutely heartbreaking to me, and BP is actually trying to keep the pictures of the animals that are covered in oil from hitting the media, but a few of them have been shown on various TV channels. It's also frustrating to me that all of BP's efforts to stop the oil, the blowout preventer, the robots that were sent down to switch the blowout preventer switch, the shutoff valves, containment dome, top hat, tube insertion, top kill, junk shot, containment cap, and eventually a relief well, which they believe will be ready in early August, that all of these things have failed. And I also think it's a shame that the help that's been offered to the U.S. government has been refused. The Dutch offered help just 3 days after the explosion, and within 2 weeks, 13 different countries had offered help, and all of it was refused. And right now, the most important thing is to get the spill stopped, and the oil cleaned up. And I also think that the EPA, which is the Environmental Protection Agency, is also hindering. BP was using a dispersant, which was called Corexit 9500, to clean up the oil that was on the ocean, but the EPA put a stop to that when they said that it was toxic, and therefore they had to use one of the 18 dispersants that were approved. However, the problem with this is that all of the 18 dispersants aren't available in the quantities that BP needs them in to clean up the oil. However, with that being said, the 18 dispersants are not BP's only option to help clean up the oil. There are tons of scientists, companies, and everyday people coming up with ingenious ideas to clean up the oil. Non-toxic ways to help clean up the oil. And a lot of the ways allow a bunch of the oil to be collected and reused. All of the solutions that I have seen are readily available, and some of them even use things that are seen in everyday life, like hay and even human hair. Once again, the EPA stepped in when a woman sent in thousands of pantyhose that were filled full of hair to be used in the Gulf to help clean up the oil, and the EPA said absolutely not, because they didn't know if the hair would be toxic or harmful to the environment. Well, how is hair more dangerous to the environment than the over 210,000 gallons of oil that's being released every day, which of that, only 15,000 is being contained? Obama has compared the oil spill to 9/11, and I would like to know if the two events are comparable. Why is he spending more time golfing than actually in the Gulf of Mexico? You would think if the two were comparable, he would be spending a lot more time in the Gulf. He did address the nation last night, and he said that if something is not working, he wants to know about it, and also that they're going to fix all of the problems that come up. Okay, well, there have been quite a few problems, and they haven't been fixed. So hopefully, he will get on that quite soon. And he also said that they're going to find out why the explosion occurred, and therefore is banning deep water drilling for 6 months while it's being investigated. 20% of the world's oil is consumed by the U.S., which is $1 billion a day that is sent to other countries for our oil, which I thought was an interesting fact, which definitely shows that we are too dependent on foreign oil. And he also expressed in basically the rest of his address that we need a clean energy future, and it needs to happen now, and it's going to be accomplished. Well, I want to know, where's the plan? If it's going to be accomplished, we need a plan of action. So I hope that he will release a plan soon. He also said that he is going to make BP have a fund for the people that are affected by the oil spill. However, he cannot legally do this, but hopefully BP will do so anyways, because it is the right thing to do. Another setback that we're having, in addition to all of the efforts of BP's trying to stop the oil spill, is that the ship that they used to put the oil on that they were getting up from the well set on fire yesterday. So they have stopped collecting oil temporarily until they can get that under control. And the spill isn't just causing harm to the animals, but also to the people that are cleaning up the oil. They have named it the Gulf Coast Syndrome, and the people that are cleaning up have come down with flu-like symptoms. And the doctors are saying that they need to monitor the people cleaning up the oil very carefully, because it could become more serious and they could have very serious complications in the long run. Day 58, and I see no relief in the near future. And the oil needs to be stopped as soon as possible. And it just saddens me that there are reports out there that the oil won't be stopped until possibly the end of December, and that is just ridiculous and unacceptable to me. And I think the saddest thing of all is that the impact of this oil spill isn't going to last years, it's going to last generations.
So thanks ever so much to Alicia and Brandy for sending that in all the way from America. That was a lovely report, really, really detailed. A lot of things that possibly we wouldn't think about. Now, if you want to have another listen to any of these reports, they will all be in our podcast, which you can access on our website, which is www.shortscience.co.uk. Now, it really is very easy to send in something for us to play out on the show. Gareth there used our recording service. Paola, Alicia and Brandy recorded their own material and sent it in by email. So now you've had a chance to hear somebody else having a go. It's your turn. So the number you need to call is +44 7401 856 681, and that accesses our recording service. Remember, that's a mobile phone call, so it's going to cost you whatever a mobile phone call would normally cost you. So that's 07401 856 681, or you can email any material to us on studio@shortscience.co.uk. And I have to say as well that Alicia and Brandy have also sent in some written material, more information about the oil spill, and that will be on our website, www.shortscience.co.uk. Well, it's nearly the end of the show, and that can only mean one thing: statistic of the week. So, what do you think is the most valuable liquid asset out of all the liquids in the world? Water, ink, bleach, blood? Well, the answer, at £44,000 per litre, is human semen. And to give you a bit of context, Hewlett-Packard printer ink comes in at £952.40 per litre, and bottled iceberg melt water, which is apparently the most expensive kind of water, is £6.20 per litre. Starbucks cappuccino comes in at £5.80 per litre. Diesel on the forecourts across Britain, approximately £1.20 per litre. And crude oil that's been causing all these problems in the Gulf of Mexico at just 30p per litre. Now, those statistics were taken from Wired magazine. Right, it's nearly time to finish for today, but we need to announce our topic for you to call in about for next week. So next week is going to be all about the World Cup football. So we are going to be trying to discover if there is any science involved in football. And we may well find that the answer is no, but we're going to have a lot of fun trying to work it all out anyway. So if you've got anything to say about football, the science of football, football matches, football players, football boots, football balls, tournaments, anything at all, call us on 07401 856 681 or send an email to studio@shortscience.co.uk. And hopefully we can have even more people calling in than this week, and a great end section to the show. So that really is all we've got time for today. But before we sign off, if you've got any comments or questions, don't forget to email us studio@shortscience.co.uk. So the website is www.shortscience.co.uk, and tomorrow the podcast will be out and available for download. Now, you can subscribe to us via iTunes. Just search for Short Science and you'll be taken directly to our page. Or you can listen to the unedited show with music or the slightly shorter podcast from our show pages on our website. So thank you very much for listening. This has been Short Science. Our contributors today were Paola Faraca, Gareth Mitchell, Alicia and Brandy Heard. The presenter was myself, Elizabeth Hawke. The production was done by our own good selves, and the theme tune was written and produced by Don Gould of Music by Design. Thank you very much for listening, and we will be back at the same time next week with another episode of Short Science.